Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, this is Joshua David Stein. You're listening to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour on Heritage Radio Network, a half-hour show devoted to all things food. Today we have a great lineup. It has some poetry, it has some prose, and it has Gelato Negro, a wonderful band singing a song about food. I'd like to start the segment with a new feature called Food Poems in an English Accent.
Food poem in an English accent.
Our first guest is Matthew Tong. Matthew, are you there?
Hello.
Oh, hi, Matthew. What kind of accent is that? Is that an English accent?
That is an English accent you are hearing, Josh.
Where? Where from? Whereabouts?
Well, it's complicated. I grew up primarily in the West Country. I was born in Dorset, and then I lived for a while with my family in Devon, and then I lived in Somerset, and then I came back to Dorset at the age of 11, and I went to a grammar school, which is basically, it's not a school you pay to go to, but you take an exam, and you pass the exam, you get to go to this school, and it's meant to be a slightly better standard of education than a regular kind of state.
Matthew,
education in the UK. Well, my point being is that my school had certain pretensions, which meant that my West Country accent was slightly, well, it was kind of kicked out of me, pretty much.
And, what's a West Country accent sound like, as opposed to, what is this?
Well, I'd be sounding a bit more like this, I guess, if I hadn't gone to that school. Okay. But I don't. I have more of a kind of RP sort of English accent, or BBC English, I suppose.
Yeah, I feel like I'm listening to the BBC News Hour with Owen Bennett Jones.
Yeah, but the South, I mean, where I primarily grew up, Bournemouth, is on the South Coast, and there's an extra thing where there's a kind of sort of a slight London influence, and that kind of comes out of my incidental fricatives, you know, i.e. TH sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Are pronounced more like F, like I'm from the South.
Right.
I can't do the incidental fricatives. I can't.
And nonetheless, I love you anyway.
Thanks.
Matthew, tell me, so today you have two poems for us, and I picked them out so I know what they are. They're by Shel Silverstein. Did growing up in England, did you ever come across his work?
No. I've never heard of him until today, when you suggested these poems for me to read.
He's a wonderful poet, mostly known here for his children's work. There's a book called Where the Sidewalk Ends, which these poems are from. But
okay.
The other thing to know about him, which I just found out, is he also wrote that Johnny Cash song, A Boy Named Sue.
I'm not aware of this song, but I shall be, I guess I'll watch it on YouTube after I've finished here.
Johnny Cash, A Boy Named Sue, nothing?
No.
Oh, well,
I'm an idiot.
No, you're English. So let's start off. The thing I like about these poems is they're really dark, actually. A lot of his children's poems are really dark, and he had a pretty dark and intense life. And
right.
I think it comes out most when he's writing about food. Will you do us the honor of reading the first one?
Yes, I will. This poem is called Point of View. Okay. Thanksgiving dinner, sad and thankless. Christmas dinner's dark and blue, when you stop and try to see it from the turkey's point of view. Sunday dinner isn't sunny. Easter feasts are just bad luck, when you see it from the viewpoint of a chicken or a duck. Oh, how I once loved tuna salad, pork and lobsters, lamb chops too, till I stopped and looked at dinner from the dinner's point of view.
That is some heavy shit right there, Matthew Tong.
It's pretty dark. I guess he's like the Charles Schultz of poetry.
Maybe Charles Schultz is also the Charles Schultz of poetry.
Yeah, perhaps.
And let's move on to the second one. What's this one called?
This second poem is called Me Skew.
Let's hear it.
I have nothing to put in my view. I'll start again. I have nothing to put in my stew, you see. Not a bone or a bean or a black-eyed pea. So I'll just climb into the pot to see if I can make a stew out of me. I'll put in some pepper and salt, and I'll sit in the bubbling water. I won't scream a bit. I'll sing while I simmer. I'll smile while I'm stewing. I'll taste myself often to see how I'm doing. I'll stir me around with this big wooden spoon and serve myself up at 12:45. So bring out your stew bowls, you gobblers and snackers. Farewell, and I hope you enjoy me with crackers.
You know, it is a rough thing to be so hungry that you cook yourself.
Right.
Matthew, thank you so much for reading these poems. Thank you for your lovely accent, and let's get dinner next week.
Let's do that. Thank you.
Okay, I'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Food poem in an English accent.
Wonderful. Now we're going to move on to another part of the program, which I don't have a theme song for yet, called Eat the Movies, which is a movie review. I do it on my own on a Tumblr. Used to do it for Eater. Today we're going to talk about a new film with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon called The Trip to Italy. Only assholes make the face so common in food movies where, after a bite of whatever divine food stuff, the diner closes his eyes, sharply inhales through his nose, and slowly lets out an exhale. No matter how delicious the bite or deliriously imaginative it is, that just doesn't happen in real life. And when it does, it's because the diner has watched too much food porn. That sigh is a foodie version of the fake orgasm. That's one reason why I loved The Trip to Italy, the second installment of Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon's food journey. There's none of that. In fact, neither man is unduly concerned about what he is eating, even though presumably the restaurant critic's on the road. That sigh never happens, though the men are eating their way through a constellation of Michelin stars. The first film found the pair traipsing through England's Lake District. This one finds them trickling down Italy's western edge. Like the original, it is also directed by Michael Winterbottom, who lets Coogan do Coogan and Brydon be Brydon, and Michael Caine, and Tom Hardy, and a lot of Al Pacino. Howdy Doody faced with sadness behind the eyes, Brydon is a master and frequent imitator, so it's not just two guys at a table, but all the guys they can conjure between the two. Winterbottom is perhaps best known for his film Nine Songs, which has more sex than your average skin flick, but somehow, mysteriously, it isn't porn. That's because he's a master at avoiding sensationalization. Sex plus salaciousness equals pornography. Eating plus sighing equals the same. But this isn't food porny at all. If anything, it's food mumblecore. To give you an idea, here's a minute from the first film. Coogan and Brydon are eating at the York Arms, a Michelin-starred restaurant in Ramsgill and Nidderdale in North Yorkshire, wherever that is.
Thank you.
Golly, that pigeon. Does look nice. That looks lovely. What is that?
Pigeon.
Really?
Yeah.
Golly.
Do you want to sit there watching you cooing over it?
Mm.
What have you got?
I have lamb. Thank you.
Farewell to the white wine.
Hello to our old friend the red.
Mmm, that's nice. That's very nice. Oh. Do you think we just have the same conversation in every restaurant?
Yeah, of course we do.
We're about essentially having the same conversation every place we go to.
I think we start out being a bit awkward with each other, have a little bit of wine, exchange a few frivolities.
Loosen up, enjoy each other's company.
To enjoy each other's company. Have a bit more wine, get cantankerous, and
pick faults with each other.
Pick faults with each other, and it descends into a kind of a sort of a bitter, unhappy end to the meal.
A couple years later, in the new film, Coogan's hair is shorter, he's paunchier, and a bit more mellow. Brydon is pretty much the same, though less happily married and more famous than before. Being in Italy, the restaurants have more vowels than before, but the discussion of the food is similarly cursory. Here they are enjoying some mind-bendingly fresh seafood on a patio in Capri.
That's fantastic.
Really, really nice. You know what makes this perfect now? Michael Bublé. A bit of Bublé. Do you like Bublé? Where do you stand on Michael Bublé?
His windpipe.
One adjective, then on to buble. Compare that with the conversations you're likely to hear or have in New York City at one of its many tasting menu-only restaurants, whose seats number in the dozen range. There, one sits with a jury of one's peers facing a toiling chef in an open kitchen. Course after course arrives, tiny bits of food on large discs of porcelain or slabs of slate. And one wonders, what shall I say? That's what I want to talk about, what we talk about when we talk about the food we are eating. At a typical high-end open kitchen tasting menu restaurant, one sits, often with one's companion, on a high stool, slowly getting trashed on the wine pairing, whilst being served delicate bites of esoteric food which, presumably, are the edible summation of the chef's soul. I've had many wonderful experiences at places like Momofuku Ko, which has 10 seats at a bar, or at Luxus, Daniel Byrne's tiny place in the back of a beer bar in Greenpoint, or even Blanca, the Sanctum Sanctorum of Roberta's, which only has 12 seats and a lot of face time. I've also had plenty of pretty hairy experiences, too. At the Little Elm, where Chef Paul LeBrant, unhappy at an earlier review I'd written, glared at me the entire meal, a hulking presence serving dishes of great delicacy. Or years ago, at Brooklyn Fair, when it was actually in Brooklyn, the temperamental chef Cesar Ramirez berated me for the audacity of taking notes. "I don't know who the fuck you think you are," he said, "but you'll never copy me." He never suspected I didn't want to. But even without the tears and drama, when all goes well, what is there to say? It is impossible not to dwell on the food, to try to capture in words all the sensations one tastes, to speculate verbosely on preparation, and to encapsulate in syllables ineffable wonder. And so for hours, for these things take hours, one limits one's topics to how swell the tartness of the lightly pickled honshumeji is paired with the kanbu-cured black bass, or at how ingenious it is to serve said bass under a translucent disc of dashi gelée, as if it is still warm in the ocean. It is not only because menus at places like these tend to be minimal and curt that a diner pokes and prods his dish, searching for ingredients or, at least, something to say. But is our enjoyment augmented by relentlessly dissecting the pleasure before us? By turning it into the object of meditation to be flogged with words and narrated like an NFL game? I don't think so. For no matter how haute the cuisine is, the primary purpose of a meal, especially at so lofty a level, is to enable pleasure. Be a good time, Sally. Yet one feels duty-bound to dwell on the details of every dish, for the chef is before you, for your perch is precious, and with the setting so monastic, to discuss anything else, from your day to Michael Bublé, seems sacrilegious. But if the tasting menu is a success, its pleasures are, for most of us, beyond the scope of language. So we goo-goo, gaga, and sigh, foundering and failing to say what we feel. Think of the opportunity cost. All the things, feelings, experiences we could be discussing. All that bonhomie we could be feeling. Hell, if we did it well enough, they might even send us to Italy to film it. Instead, we stutter, stammer, and fail. And that's when the food is great. What about when it isn't to your taste? Dare you express that? No, you daren't. That's the worst part. This dumb show isn't even an honest conversation. How could it be? When the chef, straining before you, toiling with tweezers and utterly focused, is within earshot. What I'm not advocating is that the cooking should be ignored. After all, it is true the menu is often ingenious, the dishes frequently delicious, and the experience rarefied. But I wish we could all be as relaxed and wear the experience as lightly as Coogan and Bryden do. To translate the pleasure of the plate into the joys of conversation. Though Coogan and Bryden don't wax rhapsodic about the salinity of sea urchin or the transcendent translucence of the crudo, they nevertheless seem to be enjoying themselves and the food in equal measure. That is to say, immensely. This is Joshua David Stein. You're listening to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour, and we'll be back after a short station break.
listening to It's Cold and Beautiful by Magical Mistakes. In 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
Hi, how are you? My name is Andrew WK. They say when things are very delicious, it must be Heritage Radio.
Now it's time for a musical guest who's gonna sing a song or two.
This is Joshua David Stein. Sorry, we had a bit of a water mishap here. You're listening to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour, and I am excited to welcome our first musical guest tonight, Gelato Negro.
Hello, hello.
Hold on, we have some theme music.
Okay.
For a musical guest.
Okay. They played it.
They already played it?
Yeah.
Let's play it again, right? Let's just milk that theme music.
Now it's time for a musical guest who's gonna sing a song or two.
Okay, that's better. Okay, Gelato Negro, which is tonight, it's Roberto Lang, accompanied by Jason Ajimian on bass. Roberto.
Hey.
Let's talk about Gelato Negro. You guys just came out with your fourth album.
Yes.
Double Youth. Tell me about that.
Gelato Negro is just me, and I sometimes have guests.
Your friend.
Like my friend Jason Ajimian, who's been a long time guest and collaborator in different parts. But the new record, he actually does play something on there. And to correct a mishap on my behalf, I... somehow his name didn't get included in the credits.
Okay. So now he will appear with you forevermore.
Yeah. And so I'm trying to immortalize and correct that wrong.
Yeah.
But it came out September 2nd. It's 10 songs. It's my fourth record. It's called Double Youth. And
it has an interesting genesis with this poster. Tell me about this this poster, which is also the cover art and the overriding inspiration for it. For our listeners.
Right.
Mom.
There's a poster, and the poster's a photo of my cousin and myself, like when we were like maybe 6 or 7, and we went to a youth fair and got our faces painted. But I found this poster. It's about like 18 by 16 or 18 by 12, something. It's pretty large. It's a photo poster. And I saw it, and I recognized myself, but I had no recollection of that time. And so that was essentially what the album was about, in a way. An underpinning conceptual theme was just like how you can really think that there's a moment in time where you're like, this is the best thing ever,
right?
And there's a million best things ever after that,
and at some point it's so removed that you don't even identify as having that thought or remembering that.
Absolutely.
The thing I thought was interesting about that as it pertains to food is, as you know, food is such a sense memory as well, that it's sometimes, you know, for you, it's a poster that created this album, that kind of like underpinned this album. And I feel like food has that ability to summon up all these memories. I guess what's interesting about this album is what you're saying is it didn't summon up the memories. You didn't have the memories. You knew it summoned something up, but you don't remember that day together.
Yeah, I could scientifically deduce where I was and what happened, but there was, like, I didn't have the memories. The memories weren't there. And so, yeah, like food, it has, like, that impression. You look at a photo and you're like, oh, I know what this is, but I have no idea what that is. And, like, you know, it's like a picture of a burger anywhere. Like, you know what it tastes like in your mind, but then when you have it, it's like a different burger.
Right. And sometimes better, sometimes worse.
Yeah.
You have a song for us tonight which isn't from the new record. Tell me about this song.
Yeah. Well, and we'll play a song from the record as
well. Oh, great.
But this song is called Lechuguilla, and that was off of my second record. And that song means, by definition, little lettuce. And...
Some of our listeners might note that that is a Spanish word.
yeah. So that's a song in Spanish. I mean, that's a word in Spanish and a song in Spanish. And lechuguilla comes from the word lechuga, which means lettuce. Lechuguilla means little lettuce. And the song isn't about food. The song was inspired by this documentary I saw narrated by David Attenborough about one of the deepest caves in the United States called Lechuguilla. And so then I likened the lyrics to this metaphor of all the thoughts that go through your mind when you're having sex. And so Lechuguilla being this, like, cosmic cave, you know, that, like...
This vaginal cave.
Somewhat. Or, you know, it can be either way, you know, I guess, you know. And it's just... it's kind of like all the things that go through your mind when you're having sex, in a way. But it relates to all these different things, like food and kind of mystery and... just of reappropriating names for other things.
Wonderful. Do you know why the cave is called the Little Lettuce?
I have no idea.
You have to go back and watch that documentary.
Yeah, I should know that, right?
It's okay. Let's hear that song, and then we'll go into one from the album.
Yeah.
Lechuguíame a tu lado. Lechuguíame embarazado, guíame con tu rostro, las manchas guían donde voy ahora. Pecho a pecho, pírate, que estamos lejos, dime si te quieres ir. Oh, 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 oh. Cuenta
It's wonderful. I don't want to break in. It's beautiful.
No, yeah, that was it.
Well done, guys.
Cool.
And that sounds much different from your new album. Is that because it's just a stripped-down performance, or...?
Yeah, I think, obviously, for me, obviously, just using a manual acoustic instrument, which isn't something I do. Most of everything that I do is done electronically in a computer. Just because I don't... I mean, just... That's what I know how to do.
Do you prefer one or the other, or is they're both... I mean, no offense to, you know...
No, it's... The way my songs are born, they aren't born through these kind of, like, me playing them through an instrument. That's the thing. I build songs. I'm an architect in the musical sense of building sounds and using sounds to build the song. So I'm married to the sounds for the song, essentially, when I'm building the song. And so it's not like... I think a lot of composers and musicians write songs, and then they go to a studio, and then it gets completely changed into something different. Whereas I'm constantly building the song out.
Right, like an accretion of different layers of sound.
Absolutely. And then the song is the song for me, and it's that. And then so...
Which is great, because then in this case, you kind of distill it back to something different.
Absolutely. And so then it's... Yeah, you just said it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. Do you feel like you discover new things about the song when you alter it back this way?
Yeah, because I get to hang out with my friends.
And have pizza. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, it should be coming soon. Okay, you're going to play one off the new record, too?
Yeah, we're going to play I Krill You, and this is... just a version. It's not the whole song.
Yeah,
But these are called bass appellas. And
okay,
just so you know,
in general or in this specific, just you guys.
I copied that name from someone, but I like it.
I like it as well. Before we launch into I Krill, you said something interesting about the life cycle of krill. Can you?
Oh yeah, this is actually, you know, the song I Krill You obviously uses the word krill, and it's a play on words, but krill are these tiny animals,
edible
crustacean. They're not animal. I guess they are animals.
Crustaceans are animals,
and they're eaten by whale, and we kill whales, and then the krill eat algae, and they eat too much of the algae. When they eat too much of the algae, because we killed the whales, so there's too many krill eating the algae, and then the algae produce oxygen. And the oxygen isn't being produced because the algae is getting eaten by the krill.
So this song is about life. Take it away.
With you and you and
That's the radio edit version.
That's wonderful. That was Gelato Negro playing I Krill You off their new album, Double Youth, out now. And this is Joshua David Stein. You've been listening to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour, on the Heritage Radio Network, and we'll see you next week.
That was just a musical guest who came and sang a song or two.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.